Brian Buston at the Buston Park Plaza Hotel, which is the headquarters of the 33rd Annual Cognitive Science Conference, CogSci 2011. And we're with Barbara Landau, who's the Dick and Lydia Todd Professor in Cognitive Science Department Chair at Johns Hopkins. And you've been very prominent during this meeting. You were certainly running a lot of the biology of the origins of biology of language session with Chomsky and Dave Popel and Elissa. What got you so involved in this particular conference? I mean, there was you had some
in CogSci, yeah, or in this particular session.
This particular one. Yeah.
Well, I'm on the governing board of the CogSci Society, and by coincidence, they happened to ask me to give one of the keynotes this year,
right,
so
of
I
course.
Gave that talk. But actually, the governing board, in the few years that I've been on the board, we've tried to create scenarios within the conference that will really elevate it. And one of the concepts that I worked on along with actually Alyssa Newport when she was on the board was the idea that we could have every year a special governing board symposium. And that would be sponsored exclusively by the governing board, and we would essentially think up topics that are cutting edge that people would want to hear about that also have extremely distinguished speakers. So the idea for the inaugural was the biology of language in the 21st century, and of course we knew we were going to be in Boston, so we thought this would be a perfect time to situate that topic around sort of the hub of where language studies have been over the past 50 years, and thought to ourselves, wouldn't it be wonderful if we invited Noam Chomsky to give one of the main talks, and then the other participants followed. Dave Popel is a wonderful I guess linguist, neuroscientist at NYU. And Alyssa Newport, who has views that are quite different from Chomsky, is a very prominent language acquisition researcher as well. And so those were the three people who actually spoke.
To a very full hall as well.
To an extremely full hall. I mean, it was very, very gratifying, I have to say. We thought that Chomsky would be a huge draw, and indeed he was.
Yeah. Expanding the space of cognitive science,
mm-hmm,
the theme.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to speak to that as well? Because
we were delighted. When I was on the...
Because your work is in language and space
and
as
space,
well.
And space, so. Yeah. So actually, of course, this was not my idea. It was the way that the process works at CogSci is that people, there's a call to people who would like to organize one of the conferences. And then people submit proposals, and the governing board evaluates the proposals. They read the proposals and talk to the people who are the prospective organizers. And I guess it was 2 years ago, I can't remember how far in advance we did this one, but the idea was that Cognitive Science Society meetings have been heavily about language problem-solving computational approaches, and there's been less of an outreach to other communities that I personally think are very important in cognitive science. So for example, vision scientists don't typically attend cognitive science society. Linguists don't typically attend cognitive science society. Artificial intelligence people don't always attend cognitive science society. And so actually when this idea came up, when it was proposed, to focus on the content area of space, was proposed by Laura Carlson and Tim Shipley and Christian Holscher. When they made this proposal, we thought it was a fantastic idea, and I, in particular, was very excited about it because, of course, space is one of my deep interests, and I think space and language are the two key areas within cognitive science where you have so much ability to draw people in from many different approaches, and that is the essence of cognitive science. Cognitive science is about the study of mind from different perspectives. We've been so balkanized in the past, but cognitive science is supposed to be bringing together people who use very different approaches to look at different slices of the same problem. It's a very problem-centered discipline. So the idea of using space as sort of an anchor rather than, let's say, I don't know, perhaps language, or next year I think there's going to be a focus on robotics, but space is one of those really good domains that allows you not only to focus on an important domain in cognitive science, but also to bring many communities in. And I think we did have huge attendance at this conference. So it was gratifying.
So that worked on linguistics then, bringing more linguistics?
I think that people who are in linguistics, more people came. Of course, people came to hear Chomsky. But also, I mean, I think focusing on space actually, the big draw and the big benefit was bringing people in from the vision science community and the AI community. Because when you think about spatial cognition, representation of space, obviously the visual system is the most spatial system that we have. It's very incredibly rich information. And so when you're talking about studies of visual science studies, you're talking largely about studies in the visual system. Brought in those.
How does your work fit? Could you sort of gloss your work for me so that we can...
Sure. My interest is in how we represent space and how we represent language, and then how we manage to make those two systems fit together. So they're very, very different systems. Language, of course, has its own proprietary representations and rules, and space is just a qualitatively different system or set of systems. And so my abiding question since I started graduate school actually was, how do you fit those two systems together? How do we manage to talk about space? So I end up being very interested in spatial language. But in order to know about how spatial language works, you have to know about language on the one side and about space on the other side. So I end up doing work in both areas, and then the intersection is spatial language.
But also, this presumably has educational implications as well. And you were talking to me, mentioning earlier that you've been working with Susan Magsamen.
Yeah, well, Susan and I work together actually on, I sort of admire and help her out on her projects, which have to do with outreach and the attempt to broaden the educational scenario such that you're bringing really good information about, let's say, brain development and its applications to children's learning. So, you know, her projects are, for example, the Learn website, which she'll have up very soon, in which is embedded a project called Brain 101 that I'm working on with her, where we're trying to bring information about brain development to parents and educators. And so that's a big outreach effort. My own research actually is not necessarily, doesn't have a strong educational application in and of itself. Most of my work has to do with normal development of spatial representations, how we navigate space, how children navigate space, how they represent the spatial world for the purposes of talking about space. The talk yesterday was about how children use spatial language to help their visual system, enhance their visual system, essentially. And so my interest is in basic issues of development, and then I also work on an unusual population of people who have Williams syndrome. It's a rare genetic deficit where there are severe spatial deficits, but language is really quite strong, quite spared. So that's a sort of an interesting case where one can ask, well, if you have a spatial system that's severely impaired, how do you ever learn about the language of space?
Ursula Belugi, of course, at the SALC.
Of course. Ursula Belugi was the first person who brought the case of Williams syndrome to our attention, to the attention of cognitive scientists.
And then, interestingly, Alyssa Newport worked at UCSD
Ursula. That's right. That's where she started her ASL studies as well.
Yeah. Interesting. So what is the story? You're part of the story of the Williams? I mean, how?
Well, I think that Ursula had the story right in the beginning, in one sense. So what she said was the spatial system is severely impaired, the language system is essentially spared, and her conclusion was that these are modular systems and that a neurodevelopmental genetic disorder can impair one module but not the other. I think that part of it is probably needs to be modulated. So what I've been doing for the past 12 or 13 years, essentially, since I started looking at people with Williams syndrome, was studying a very broad range of spatial systems and what that deficit could be like, how we can best characterize the spatial deficit, because spatial cognition is not sort of one big system. We don't have one big system that is useful for navigating and for perceiving visual scenarios and recognizing objects and perceiving biological motion. It's not one system. They're separate systems. So in order to understand the spatial profile of people with Williams syndrome who have this deficit, you need to look at every system, or many of them. So we've been doing that. And then on the other hand, we've also been looking at their language. And I think she's quite right. Their language actually is extremely well-structured and very rich. The spatial system is impaired, but very selectively so. So for example, object recognition actually looks quite good. But tasks that involve visual spatial construction, or especially certain kinds of navigation tasks, they're severely impaired. So it's a very uneven profile within the spatial systems. My hypothesis for how we put all of this together for the Williams syndrome to try to understand it is not that there's one module that's blown out and the other one is spared, but rather that actually the profile of a person with Williams syndrome is very similar, actually, to a normally developing 4 or 5-year-old. And the reason that's true is, I think, they undergo very, very, very slow development in both systems, right, in language and in the various spatial systems. But then at some point it stops, so it's essentially developmental arrest. And the way to think about this is, if you think about the difference between a spatial profile and a language profile of a 4-year-old, I don't know if you know any 4-year-olds, or have talked to any recently, but they're very verbal. You know, they have amazingly rich linguistic structure. You can do experiments with them and find that they have rich representations of hierarchical structure and so forth, and sophisticated semantics, but they can't tie their shoes. Okay? So a normal 4-year-old actually has a very limited repertoire in terms of space. It's ups and downs, but it's limited, and the spatial systems undergo very long trajectory of development. So you don't have a fully developed spatial system until you're an adolescent, whereas your linguistic system is probably done by the time you're 4 or 5 years old. So if you're developing very, very slowly, and you keep on developing, but then you have developmental arrest at the functional level of a 4-year-old, you'll look like a person with Williams syndrome or a normally developing 4 or 5-year-old. Namely, you'll have really good language and not such good, pretty impaired space.
What's your sense of what the neurocognitive architecture is like? I mean, what model of the mind do you subscribe to?
Well, I actually am a person who is, I'll say it, I'm a nativist. What I think that means is that we have very strong innate biases, structural biases. I think that there's this tension between the view that there are many, many, many modules in the brain. Everything's modular and nothing's modular. And I'm in the middle there. So I think there are modular systems that are specially represented in the brain by particular areas of tissue that probably have computational properties that we do not understand at this point. And I think there are probably also some general purpose mechanisms. So, we have things like memory, which is ubiquitous in the brain. It has to be. I mean, so the ability to learn involves changes in synaptic transmission and so forth, and that's got to be a ubiquitous property of the brain. On the other hand, you have areas such as, the fusiform face area, the FFA, which really the tissue just responds very specialized to faces. There are particular stimuli that elicit it. You see it in infancy. If not in the brain, you see it, developmentally, but you certainly see very specialized responses to face stimuli by even infants. And so I think there are areas such as that really are highly specialized. Another one that was discussed in one of the space symposia a couple of days ago by Neil Burgess is the hippocampus and the areas around the hippocampus, which are, I think everybody would agree that there is a high degree of specialization for some kind of spatial function in the hippocampus. So that's another system that where the architecture of the hippocampus somehow is the architecture that takes in spatial information about navigation and helps us to move through space in a directed fashion. Interestingly, one of the functions, I think, important spatial functions, is recovering from disorientation. And so if you get spun around in a room or in any environment, you can imagine getting disoriented.
Yeah.
And then you have to recover yourself, reorient yourself. And that particular function, reorientation, is probably, if not exclusively carried by, largely carried by structures around the hippocampus. And that's a function that people with Williams syndrome actually are extremely bad at. So you can't, you know, they have very hard times reorienting themselves. So that kind of evidence from neurological cases, is one of the pieces of evidence that we have for specialization. If you have damage in this particular area, then the prediction is, if it's specialized, you should be losing one particular function and, you know, not a variety of other ones.
You mentioned a project you're working on with an artist. Could you tell me that story?
There is a well-known illustrator who did considerable work that was very high profile. For example, she did a number, about 5 or 6 New Yorker covers. She worked with the New York Times and did illustrations for major writers. She has a piece hanging that was done for Clinton and Gore for a HUD project. Very high profile artist who several years ago suffered from viral encephalitis. And viral encephalitis, if it reaches the brain, well, in viral encephalitis, it reaches the brain and has extremely severe damaging effects, especially usually on the medial temporal lobe, hippocampal area. So as a consequence, she became initially aphasic, recovered her language actually quite rapidly, but is deeply amnesic. So she has severely impaired memory for everyday events. So for example, one of the tasks that we've done with her, because we're studying her amnesia, is we gave her a figure to copy, and if it's right in front of her, she can copy it perfectly. If we then turn the page over and ask her to draw what she just saw, it's extremely impoverished. And then if we ask her to draw what she remembers 5 minutes later, she doesn't even remember having drawn the piece. Okay, so severe amnesia. The interesting thing about this is twofold. First of all, we're very interested in her profile from the perspective of what parts of the cognitive system are still quite strongly preserved, and her language is very good, and some aspects of spatial cognition are very, very strongly preserved. Other aspects are deeply impaired. So for example, she is extremely prosopagnosic. She has problems with face recognition. She can't recognize very famous places, so you show her the Great Wall of China, she doesn't know what it is, even though she used that in a piece of art before illness. The second thing that's really interesting about the case is that her family, since the episode, her family is artists as well, her family intervened and has been doing some art therapy to bring back her art, and so she started to recover her art after maybe 4 months post the most critical phase of the illness. And she started off not being able to create art really, but started off by using her language. So what she began doing, there was a critical turning point where a neighbor brought by a word find book, where you have a list of words and they're all jumbled in a grid and you find them, you circle them. She loved it, she got completely hooked on it, wanted more puzzles, did, you know, 100 of them in a couple of days, and then started creating her own word lists. So she started creating word lists that were, for example, you know, all of the things you eat for breakfast, or she created word lists that started with the same sound, all the things that start with B, and so forth and so on. She then started making grids, physical grids on paper, where she would then insert the words to make an organized crossword puzzle, essentially. After that, after she started doing the grids, she started building the art around the grids, so that what happened, for example, in one of the earlier puzzles that she created was she had a list of words that were things that you hang in a closet. That was her word list. And the word list became embedded in an artistic piece, which was the shape of a hanger with a grid inside, and the words would go in the grid. And as this built, she actually continued to do grids and make word lists, insert the grid, and create the art. And it accelerated to the point that she's done thousands and thousands of puzzles in the context of 2 years or so, some of them becoming almost hypergraphic, so extremely complex with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of words. But the art is beginning to come back. So her family actually collected this, what they called recovery art. So there are two things that we're doing now, and I'm working with Mike McCloskey at Hopkins on this project, and we're funded by the Brain Sciences Institute at Hopkins to do this work. We're doing the science where we're actually testing her cognitive functions, a variety of trying to figure out some properties of the amnesia, and also working on, for example, her language functioning and her spatial functioning. The other part of it is that we're actually partnering with the Walters Art Museum in Baltimore for an exhibit. And the exhibit is opening on September 17th and will run through December. And it's actually her pre-art, New Yorker covers, New York Times pieces, and so forth. The episode, and we have information about the viral encephalitis, we have the brain scan that shows where the damage was, and then all of the recovery art from about 4 months after the illness all the way up through a couple of months ago. So it's a real marriage of science and art, and we're totally thrilled. And you know, we don't have any answers yet as to exactly what that cognitive, what her cognitive system looks like and how it is that she came to recover the art. But what's fascinating about it is that her strong language, the abilities that were preserved, served as the entree to creating the art. So it's just a fascinating and very unique case.
The importance of neuroscience to cognitive science?
I think it's really important. But I think that David Popel was really right on in his talk yesterday, where he said, we are so far from understanding how to map between the level at which neuroscientists can look at synapses, for example, or the properties of neurons, and the symbolic architectures that we think are extremely important, the representations we think are really important for cognition. We don't have a clue as to how to make those two things work, and it's largely because we don't understand the computational properties well enough of areas in the brain.
Yeah. What was your own trajectory into this world?
Into the field?
Why science at all? Something happened at school?
Thank you for asking that question. My father was a physicist. My mother was a musician. And I actually never thought I'd go into science. So I think there was a little bit actually of sort of intimidation in the air because you're living in the household with a brilliant physicist and mathematician, and you sort of can't do those hard problems that are presented at the dinner table. So I actually shied away from science and math early on. But I attended, as an undergraduate, I went to Penn, University of Pennsylvania, and which has a very strong psychology department, or had at that time. Found psychology really interesting, but hard. Subsequently graduated and didn't know what I was going to do, and sort of fooled around with various educational applications. So I worked at ETS for a little while, and then I went back to graduate school in educational psychology. Discovered very rapidly that that was not enough science for me. And then I actually landed at Penn and met Lila Gleitman, who was my mentor, my advisor, and I knew instantly when I first began talking to her about language learning that that was it, and that was the level at which I wanted to be able to think and learn. So I went to graduate school at Penn, and that turned my life around. I mean, that was what made me a scientist, I think.
What's your advice to a young scientist now, when you have your own students and so on? What have you learned that you'd like to pass on?
I think that, honestly, one of the crucial factors in my own development was the support that I got from mentors, advisors, senior colleagues. And I take mentoring very seriously. And it's especially true for young women who feel that sometimes that it's hard, it's very competitive. Maybe you're not as aggressive as you might have to be. And so the advice is always you can do it. And don't worry about, you know, don't get sort of burnt out in the early days. Understand that there's a really long trajectory, and understand that things change. So as I said, I always tell them the story about that I didn't start out as a scientist, really. I mean, maybe it really was all the time, but I didn't think I was going to be. And you take things one step at a time, and the best advice is to figure out what your passion is. And once you have that passion, if you have to know the answer, I mean, that's what I always felt, is I have to understand this. And once you feel that, then nothing can stop you. So if you go, I mean, this is what I tell my own children as well, you know, you just find what you're passionate about and follow that. And you know, there are things like, if you have a good mentor, it really, really helps.
So Henry and Lila Gleitman, I mean,
were amazing. And also Liz Spelke, actually, who was a young assistant professor when I was a graduate student. So actually my earliest work on space, which was in space and language in The Blind Child, was my dissertation work. And my first project was on spatial navigation in the congenitally blind child, and I worked on that with Liz Spelke and Henry Gleitman. That was my very first project. So they were all amazing mentors, especially Lila and Henry, who of course were quite senior. And the other thing is that the environment at Penn at that time was one of remarkable support for the graduate students. So I remember Paul Rosen, who was a faculty member, is still at Penn, articulating it that the way that the faculty felt about graduate students at Penn was that they were young colleagues. That's a very different approach to dealing with graduate students than some of the horror stories you hear, where the graduate students are slaves or they're, you know, being intimidated and so forth. And so that context in which you're treated as a potential flower to be nurtured and encouraged is enormously important, was enormously important. And I think to the whole cadre of students who were at Penn in that time, and I think there's really a remarkable set of students, set of scholars who came out of Penn during the 70s and early mid-80s.
On a larger scale, though, the place of science in society, the president talking about restoring science to the rightful place, what is the
rightful
place? Crucial.
I mean, it is so crucial. So I think we have to, we all play a very, very vital role in educating people, in helping them to think scientifically, even though they think they can't. So I teach a course called Cognitive Development, undergraduates, and I teach them about genetic anomalies, genetic deficits. I teach them about the role of biology. I teach them about prematurity. I teach them about things that actually matter in the world. And what I hope that they can get out of this is the ability to think hard and be skeptical and be probing about what they read in the popular press. So I think one of the things that we can really do to help society is to help people understand how to think about issues well, how to analyze data that they're presented with well, and to be skeptical. In the right sense. So I think science is absolutely crucial to society. And of course, you know, the obvious things such as, you know, we want to discover the cure for cancer. We want to figure out how to make the life of a person who has a spatial disorder better and so forth. But there is this broader function of just educating people as to the value of science and making people into intuitive scientists.
You're a member of the Governing Board of Cognitive Science Society. Next year, the 34th Annual Science is going to be in Japan. Mm-hmm. So what's the Governing Board thinking about here? I mean, because it really seems to be, the society has been on a roll for a number of years now, and it's just building momentum.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the plans for the meeting next year are really exciting. The focus is, if you're talking about the intellectual focus, I think it's going to be around robotics. Although, you know, the theme is building bridges, and so I think the idea is there is building a bridge to Asia, building international bridges. It wasn't so long ago that CogSci was only in the United States, so that actually the first time that it was to be held in Europe, there was a lot of concern that people wouldn't come, you know, there would be limited interest, maybe the cognitive scientists in Europe wouldn't even think it was important. And it turned out to be a huge success. So I think that this step of doing it in Asia is actually one of the goals is to broaden further. So that's the building bridges theme. But then the intellectual theme, I think, is on robotics, and that should be fantastic. So it extends again. I think it's another step in the direction of trying to select an intellectual topic that has the ability to draw in people from artificial intelligence, linguistics, you know, neuroscience, and so forth.
Right. 30 years of Mars Vision, levels of analyzing cognitive science. David Marr's name keeps coming up a lot in this meet, mm-hmm. I heard. What's your take on his analysis?
I think levels? He set the problem exactly correctly. I think not enough of us in any of our intellectual endeavors in any of the related fields, not enough people think about the challenge of coming up with adequate theories at every level. Think about the need to have multiple levels of representation. So, you know, I mean, connectionist models look like they don't have a lot of depth in terms of different levels of analysis, from my perspective. Some neuroscientists who work at the level of synapse, sometimes I think don't appreciate the need for a level of representation that is much higher level, a symbolic level of representation. And in fact, that's a real problem in, there is a problem I think that we have in the field of getting these two ends of the story to talk to each other and to understand that not only are both levels necessary, really necessary, not just superfluous, not just like these are ways that we could think about the mind, but they're real. The symbolic representations are real. There's also this big problem, again, going back to David Popel's talk, about that we haven't a clue how to make these things work together. We just don't know. And I think what we have to do is start going from trying to do mappings between adjacent levels rather than trying to take the whole big chunk. But we have to all understand that you need all those levels.
Yes, I'm going to give you a time travel token with which you can bring anybody to your dinner table from any period of history.
Uh-oh.
Okay. And any discipline.
Marie Curie. Okay.
Why?
Well, you know, again, this is very personal. She's one of my role models. Darwin, another one of my role models. I mean, I can leave it at those two and just tell you a little bit about why. I love Darwin. I love the idea that Darwin didn't exactly know what he was looking for. He was something else. He was, you know, doing whatever he was doing, and he was on his voyage, and he tripped over something. He saw something, and his observational, he knew it was important. He started collecting species of different samples and, you know, took them back to England, and it wasn't for years and years that he actually developed his theory. So what I love about Darwin is the idea that science is a slow process, and we have to respect the hunch. Right? That's Darwin. Marie Curie, brilliant scientist, who, you know, a woman in the 19th century, was probably not as revered as she should be, although she certainly ended up being, of course, extremely well respected. But to be a woman in the 19th century and working on these intense problems, and then to die from your own research, essentially, she's just a heroine of mine.
You know, I asked leading women scientists this, whether I should retire this question about was it harder for them, or have things equalized? And they say, no, keep asking.
Keep asking. Keep asking. And ask frequently.
Yeah.
Okay? And the reason is we've got to know, we have to keep reminding ourselves that things are far from done. So my mentor, Lila Gleitman, came up in a very different time than I did, for example, and I think things really have changed from then to now. You know, there were times when people like Eleanor Gibson, for example, didn't have a regular faculty position. Dorothy Hurvich, married to Leo Hurvich at Penn, originally did not have a regular faculty position. So women of that generation really were, you know, if they made it to scientific prominence, as these women all did, it was really hard. It's easier now, but there's still a struggle. And it's you know, there's a lot of work to do, and we all have to be doing everything to continue to be aware of the problem, to be creative in thinking up ways to remediate the problem. And so it's a really good question to ask. I think keeping it at the forefront of people's attention is really important.
Did you ever consider doing anything else? I mean, is there anything else that you would have liked to have been? Are you a frustrated opera singer or something like that?
Did you say that I was frustrated that I hadn't done G-Meet? Is that what you asked?
No, I'm saying, is there something that you wished you'd... another career that you might have easily chosen?
I mean, I
have... Because your mother was...
Yeah, she was a musician, music teacher, but a pianist. I was not musical enough to do that. I've often thought that I actually could have taken quite a number of different paths. I'm completely thrilled with the path I've taken, and I know that I'm really a scientist at heart. But I have often thought I could have gone the route of running some kind of a foundation, so doing some kind of work that was more outreach, but sort of slightly less science-based, but sort of managing a portfolio that would help science. That's one possibility. I actually had an interest in fashion at one time. I think I could have gone into that, but I think it wouldn't have been as satisfying for me as I know myself now.
So where do you see this field going over the next few years?
Well, I'm worried and I'm hopeful. I'm worried about this issue that we've talked about before about getting people to understand that you need all levels of representation, all levels of description, and making the connection between those. But I'm hopeful in that I think people are, that as we draw in sort of more perspectives to a single problem, we really can make advances. So I think we desperately need people who are experts in computational approaches who can help us understand what the tissue's doing in the brain. And we desperately need them to work with theorists, linguists, for example, to understand how would you implement that kind of a structure in a computational model. But I'm sort of hopeful because I think that's actually on everybody's radar screen. So I think that's a good first step. I'd also love to see the field go in the direction, the more cognitive neuroscience approaches go in the direction of remediation. So training studies and for people who've had brain damage, children and adults. And then, of course, that leads to applications for education, which I think are really crucial. I think we're in a better position than we've ever been to try to start developing applications that are really science-based, rather than sort of whatever I think, which has tended historically to, I think, be the way that too many programs go.
Hmm. Well, my last question was going to be, what are you optimistic about? But it sounds like that's
what I'm optimistic about. And I'm also optimistic about the next generation of scientists. I mean, I think we've got fantastic people who are coming up that we see as graduate students and postdocs. It's exciting. It's actually an exciting time, and it's really fun for me to sort of watch. It's not yet the changing of the guard, but to watch new excitement come into the field. I think it's wonderful.
Barbara Lander, thanks very much.
Thank you.